This is Rapholix After Hours.
Welcome back to Rack Addicts After Hours. This is going to be episode 22. Thank you for tuning in. I'm joined by Telmo and Pete over the internet now. And the usual weekly catch-up. Telmo, have you been up to anything exciting?
Exciting days are ahead of me. Ooh. And this week I can see the end of the light of the tunnel for my coursework. So I've got one more project to go. That's studio production. So I've got two to three songs still quite decided. To submit, so that's exciting. So from next week onwards, I will start buying rum again.
I see. Have you just been avoiding the avoiding any kind of drink while you've been doing coursework?
Yeah, so I squeezed the limes, I got a little bit of a sparkling water, put some ice in it, and I just imagine the rum.
That gets you through the evenings of hard work.
Exactly. How about you? How about you, Ben?
I actually borrowed a Chase Bliss Mood from our colleague Joe. So that's a granulary, loopery, reverby, ambient-y
that's
pink
a really
box
nice
of joy.
Pedal, man.
And I've skimmed the manual, but that's all I want to do. And it's really, really fun. I actually, after, I think it's two episodes ago, after we finished recording that, I had a quick chat with Pete about, do I buy this one very expensive module? So I've been digging into the Instruo CSL complex oscillator as well, and it was worth it. So thank you for convincing me, Pete. It's pretty joyous. Yeah,
I'm the last person anyone should talk to about resisting purchasing their equipment. You know, they're doomed.
Yeah, it was the right choice though. It's really, really, really tasty. So a bit of that, bit more baking. Just done another loaf of bread today. And precisely nothing else. Pete.
Right, well, I've actually finished the main board on the hex mix now.
Ooh, nice one.
So I'm going to start on the, well, it's the control board, isn't it? So you've got the two boards that make it up. But I have been taking my time on that particular project and really sort of just doing a little bit and then putting it down again and getting on with other things. So
what do you do, like solder all the 10Ks or something and then go
I had to order send out for more rolls of solder because the roll of and I use lead solder because I don't have to sort of comply with any sort of things because I'm not using them commercially. I'd been using 1.2 millimeter, and I think I'd had that solder for about 20 years. It was about half a kilo or something like that of it. It's a big roll.
Oh, yeah.
So I've ordered
1 millimeter,
and I've already got some really small. I think it's almost the smallest gauge you can do. And I use that's the small gauge I use for surface mount. I really should be using paste and the heat gun, but
yeah, it's nice to have the control when you've got really thin solder. But then what I found is if you're just doing through hole stuff and the solder's too thin, you kind of I normally hold the roll, just kind of spool it off a finger and then pull it out. I end up just sort of spooling out a little bit and then shoving the entire thing just to do like two joints because it's so thin.
Take it real quick if it's too thin. So it's gauging it just right. But I do notice, I don't know if that's unique to a thing, but I wasn't aware that the, even if you use lead solder now, the actual cores are actually, the flux cores are actually water soluble, which is something I noticed when I was making my purchase from my preferred supplier of that type of equipment.
Why would you want water soluble cores?
I don't know, maybe it's a although they haven't banned lead solder yet, and although almost or if not all commercial products won't be using lead solder. I know the military still use lead for the sort of the important stuff, but I would imagine all consumer electronics now would be lead free to comply with that. Maybe the type of flux they're using now has had to be altered, even in the lead stuff, so that it's compliant.
Yeah, it was normally rosin's the classic material, yes. Isn't it? Not that I really know what that is, to be honest. All I remember it from is my sister played violin. She had a block of the stuff to get the bow all dusty. I have no idea what it actually does. But, good to have a bit of soldering available to you. Just watch out when you get to join the the front panel and all of the pots and stuff. I think I said before that's a nightmare.
Yes, I've done other modules where there's a quite high density of potentiometers and switches on the front, and always use the front faceplate as the sort of guide and sort of have the faceplate on there and use that to sort of make sure everything's in the right place, because there wouldn't be anything worse than soldering everything on and then find you can't actually get the faceplate on because they don't align up with the holes.
Especially with that many components.
That's probably one of the reasons why this DIY kit that I got, it comes with little connectors instead of the soldering. I'm not very good at explaining myself, to be fair, on this sort of occasion. Instead of soldering into the PCB, there's like a little connector and you just put the cable.
The push fit plug and play would be a lot easier in most
cases.
Yeah,
that's it. It's a kid's DIY kit, but sounds great anyway.
So I've also gone on a little splurge in respect to buying all sorts of spurious things. But one of them I've asked to order a Euclidean circle kit.
Oh, does he do kits?
Yes. And it's nice version 2, which is just...
one that I recently sold.
So I haven't had a response, which seems to be the rigour at the moment, because I still haven't had a response to the sequencer that I was hoping to purchase.
Oh, of course, yeah.
So I've heard nothing, even though the website stated that they normally answer emails within an hour, if not sooner, and a week's gone by. But I don't really want to hassle them, because in this current situation that we're in, who knows what situation they're in, if you see what I'm saying. So I don't want to be seen as persistent, going, you haven't answered my email, when can I? Yep. But it seems to be quite reasonable. The kit, or certainly the circuit boards and the faceplate, is €55 plus €7 shipping.
Not bad. And I mean, I know from that one there's going to the faceplate's definitely actually PCB, because you've got to solder LEDs to the front.
Yes.
And potentially some, I mean, the encoders you need would be clicky and like notched clicky and clickable in. Shouldn't be that hard to find, but that should be an interesting project, actually, soldering on both sides.
Yes, I don't know what to expect. And they published the build for it, or not just the build sheets, but the BOM. And that's at Mauser. And it seemed to be, it was incredibly inexpensive. The build was only... component-wise, it was about, if I got this right, I'm sure it's only about £7 or something. I mean, the whole module, in reality, is good. In theory, it looks like it's going to be very inexpensive, unless I've done my sums wrong.
Would you reckon under £100 if you...
Oh, definitely, way under £100.
I'm thinking I might just have another one again.
I'm thinking more around
it. It costs like €230-odd Euros to buy it.
Yes, they're definitely quite expensive. And I thought, I think maybe because it's not exactly an easy, it's a lot of surface mount, so it's not for everyone.
Yeah, definitely. It's a fantastic module. One of the prettier ones out there as well, just because of the really nice sort of multicolour LEDs. Really good.
Yeah, so hopefully I'll hear back from the Vladimir, I believe?
Vladimir, yeah. Vladimir P. His surname begins with P. I had a couple of emails with him a while ago. Really, really cool guy.
And he responded quite quickly, which he hasn't done in...
He did then, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just not getting emails from a lot of these people. So I didn't get the Omsomic one. I didn't get the one from Vladimir either. I mean, you start getting paranoid and wondering if they're actually getting your emails in the first place, you think.
Oh, yeah.
But as I said earlier, I'm very loath to email back and say, did you receive my email? I'm going to start sounding like some whiny punter that... wants to,
like all the people we deal with at work.
Who knows what...
Soft way of saying that is just send it back again, as you are not quite sure if you've sent it. That's what I normally do. Just forward it again to the same person every 2 days.
Well, if I don't hear back from Omsomic, I'm going to... Because they did that the sequencer in partnership with a organisation in Bristol. It's a one of these educational... establishments, you know, studio production education. So I'm not quite sure what their involvement was, but I thought that if I didn't hear anything, I might contact them and say, is there an issue? Because, I mean, they could be going through all sorts of stress and issues, you know.
More stress on whatever fire.
Yes, exactly.
Pete, have you been browsing the eBay again?
Yes, I have. I often indulge in sort of fantasy shopping there or see what's going on. And invariably synths and other pieces of musical and studio equipment. I've noticed that some items gaining quite exorbitant pricing, which I thought was quite strange because it wasn't as if these items aren't necessarily available through retailers. I mean, some of them are. Some of them are out of stock.
Which items in particular? Is it vintage items? Is it new pre-owned items?
Well, vintage stuff always seems to be on an upward trajectory anyway, depending on what it is. But there's always that sort of upswing, some more intense than others. But no, this was current items. Sometimes, I mean, it does depend on what geographic location. I tend to sort of focus in on sort of UK because it invariably, a lot of the times, it's quite impractical to buy something from, let's say, the US or Japan because of the import duties and transportation, yeah. Things like
you've
that. But this, yeah. this was stuff yeah. that's definitely current items, and it was just the price. Oh, the one that stuck out was things like the Behringer TD3, which I saw them going for up to £300 a go, which was seems
instead
to be quite
of the 130
ridiculous.
Quid they are most places.
I know that the sort of the stock levels are, I mean, are pretty low or non-existent with a lot of retailers, but I can't imagine it's going to be too long before Behringer managed to get some stock into Europe.
It kind of surprises me because obviously, you know, this sort of people are buying stuff without any warranty. So you need to realize that if you're going to push the price of an item that's current to the market, that's still not discontinued or whatever, you need to reduce the price in order to understand that that person is not paying for a, you know, for a company's warranty. Maybe the product's warranty, but
you'd want it if it's Behringer.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Behringer's great, and we've talked about the B word for many, many times during many, many days. But we all know the hassle that it can be if it's broken, and that happens quite a lot.
Especially if you're an early adopter of any of their synths that have more software-y elements, at least.
Mm. Yeah,
well, that's definitely a very good point, Telmo. And as we, I mean, I'm always saying to customers when they question sort of certain pricing, that try and emphasise that with all goods, especially electrical or electronic goods, a good proportion of the retail cost is the warranty component of it. And as soon as there isn't a warranty, item potentially could lose quite a lot of value. I mean, that is dependent on what type of thing it is and or how much supply there is once it becomes a second-hand item. But I also was considering that whether we're going to start seeing quite dramatic price increases on new equipment. As the, I mean, we spoke about quite a few episodes ago when this whole situation descended on the whole world that supply chains would be disrupted. Which is still the case to a greater degree. But even after that point, potentially, we're going to start seeing items increasing or prices starting to inflate for a whole variety of reasons, especially if manufacturers find themselves in a situation whereby they have to potentially build their equipment more locally, relinquishing the reliance on China as the world's factory because of the problematic situation. Because as we've seen with sort of other vital supplies, lo and behold, you suddenly realise that it's all made in China.
Well, yeah, with kind of any inefficiencies in working or staff shortages in the R&D section, that will increase costs as well, even outside of any areas that would have kind of supply and demand changes. Mm.
Isn't also an issue, because we're talking about new products, but if we want to decrease production, and if you know, increasing production is a problem, why don't we put some sort of like a price cap on vintage products? Why don't we have that sort of thing applied so that we can sustain reusability of products? I was actually recently looking at a few 80s Roland synths, and I came across an RS-09, which not a lot of people know about. I didn't.
Is that one the string synth?
Yeah, that's an organ and string synth. Yeah.
I think Ian from the Modular Cafe has one of the other, the RS synths.
Nice.
Anyway, continue.
No, they're really nice, man, and they're the Junos, the string sound of a Juno. Obviously, you don't have the brass, but this is the sound of a Juno, which is from the same period as well. So they used to. The price is also going up. We're running out of vintage gear that we can actually start to afford these days. So it could be maybe an interesting idea, you know, put a price cap into these products if you want to.
The question would be enforcing something like that. That's not really going to work.
Yeah.
That's exactly my sentiment. I mean, it's a supply and demand. I mean, a thing is worth as much as someone's prepared to pay for it. So obviously we've seen that with Roland Classic synths, which have reached sort of historical pricing in the last sort of 5 to 10 years. The usual classics, the Jupiter 8s, Jupiter 6s and Jupiter 4s, Junos and so forth. I mean, I know that potentially I had thought with the Behringer releasing a lot of the kind of tributes, as we should call them, not copies, that would kind of maybe depress pricing in some respect. You know, in reality, we all know that as good as they are for the money they are, they don't quite sound like the real thing.
Yeah, it depends how nerdy you are about really getting the exact sound. They capture the vibe really well. I mean, we've said it before. If you want that one classic synth bass sound, Behringer Model D, I'll take you there.
Yeah,
but it's also that it's a diminishing supply because the real completists who are collecting all these synths are not letting them go. Once they've got them, they've got them. They're not reselling them, and as time goes on, they are starting to wear out. You get the less functional ones are broken down for spares. I mean, if I don't know if you guys have watched any of the particular company called Sintar in the States.
I've seen a few of their videos.
No.
They specialize in synth renovation, and they go around sort of collecting up all the sort of versions that they can get of various different things. And if they're in good enough condition, they'll refurb them and resell them again. But if they're not, they'll just break them down and sort of break them for parts.
Well, those are the companies that we need, I think. We need to focus more on reusability, and I think we had enough time during this quarantine, just as a population in general, to start thinking less about consumerism. I mean, but this is just my personal opinion in that matter.
No, I totally agree with you, Tamo. Like, I had when we went to the farm shop that you recommended for the second time,
nice.
Had a shop with one piece of plastic in it, which was very pleasing. That was really nice.
There we go.
I just needed some grapes and they were in plastic. Oh, well.
You cried a little, didn't
just
you?
Just a little.
No, I totally agree with the sentiment you're expressing there, Telmo, but I fear that really once, however long this takes, we kind of get past this, people will very readily slip back into their old ways. This is the trouble.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of sentiment around at the moment that, that some good potentially could be gleaned from this whole scenario. And things need to change. And I think a lot of people realise things need to change. But at the end of the day, will they really change? I mean, let's hope so.
Yeah, let's trust in humanity.
Yeah, no, it's not going to work. Telmo, you have a little section, little news article. Would you like to take us that way? Because this is going to get a little bit... Not muso-y, but it's going to be definitely an education for me because I have no idea who this guy is, what he plays, anything. But take us
all
through
right.
some news, Telmo.
Let's talk about jazz.
that's the jingle for our new segment with Telmo. Talk about jazz with Telmo.
I need to.
Don't worry,
that,
I'll
but,
use that section and do something with it.
Brilliant. So today we will talk about a legend that unfortunately has left us last week. His name was Tony Allen. He was a drummer. He died on Thursday, the 13th, at the age of 79. Yeah, 79. For those who are not familiar with Tony Oladipo Allen, he was one of the fathering founders of a genre called Afrobeat. So he was a drummer, a composer, a songwriter, a band leader that lived in Europe for most of his later years. He spent his last years in Paris. And he was the musical director for Fela Kuti's band, Africa 70, from 1968 to 1979. He was, being a guy that created and developed a whole genre, Afrobeat, which was sampled through, you know, various other genres that you can think of developed from Afrobeat itself.
So what is Afrobeat to somebody like me who has absolutely
question.
No idea?
So Afrobeat is African roots rhythm that you can think, which kind of started with jazz and started up with funk. But it's this really rapidly 32-note rhythmic sense of African rhythm. And then mixed with modern funk and modern jazz, which again it developed in the 70s because funk was also a big part of the sound of the 70s, and then jazz fusion, jazz funk, Afrobeat became this whole thing for rhythmic enthusiastics, even up to this day, really. I mean, I think we're near London, and it's a very exciting time to be living at in London right now, because there's this whole emerging of Afro jazz and Afro pop happening in town. Bands like Kokoroko, I actually had the pleasure to play with a drummer for Kokoroko, Ayo, if you're listening, how you doing? You know, he is from that school, from that Tony Allen school, from that incredibly syncopated rhythm. You know, you can imagine the brass sections and the trumpets, but it's not in the New Orleans style. It's in a roots African style, which is very interesting, and it's very refreshing to hear that mixed with jazz. So that's a big part of the sound in London right now. Like Moses Boyd, I think he actually is a drummer. He did a couple of years ago, I think, a little drum clinic with Tony Allen himself here in London.
So would you describe it that as world music, or is that a bit of a sort of misdescription?
No, not at all. No, I think it could be considered world music. It was mostly developed in America, but its origins go back to Nigeria and actually earlier than that to Ghana in the 1920s. Again, so the same sort of rhythms that you hear in early jazz, with the slavery boats coming into the South of America, into the Deep South, spreading that sort of sound, is the same that influenced this whole movement.
Telmo with the knowledge bomb. Thank you.
No worries, man.
On the subject of world music, while we're here, is there any particular other genres that you guys are interested in or have felt that, you know, that it did something for you?
Yeah, something worldier and from another nationality. I'm struggling to think of anything that I've heard that hasn't been, you know, directly Western in origin. Mm. So I'm gonna think on that. But Telmo, you take it away.
I suppose you could consider English folk some sort of world music, right? Like old folk songs. Is that?
I guess it makes sense.
Yeah, I would imagine any sort of folk tradition is could be considered in that respect. For me, there's a couple of sort of genres that I've always found quite pleasant to the ear. And one of them is West African kora playing, music. And I'm talking about the more traditional pieces where you get in soloists and maybe duets playing. There's something particular about that instrument that I find it quite haunting. And not when you've got some of the rhythm sections or maybe some of the singing. It's just that particular instrument on its own. It's got to a degree, it calls back to something that, you know, more dear to your heart, Ben, being a Genesis fan, or in particular Peter Gabriel, because he was very inspired and got had been very involved with world music for several decades now. And he
That's true. I haven't really dug into Peter Gabriel's back catalogue enough to fully appreciate that kind of thing.
But he was also one of the driving forces behind the WOMAD Festival, which is very much centred on this type of thing and so forth. The other one that I always found quite good on the ear as well is traditional sort of Peruvian panpipe stuff. But again, with going back to the core, it's not when they try and cross over and try and bring in some sort of Western. It's when they stick to the really traditional melodies and the traditional style. Once they start doing a bit of fusion with it, it loses me. But if they stick to the pure form of both of them, both those two, and the very sort of nice sounding instruments.
Absolutely. I agree with the fact that world music, just to kind of like bring what you said together, it's something that, you know, it's intrinsic in pop music in general, but we don't really know until we start digging in, until we start kind of understand where all these people come from. Like, I mostly listen to pop music and westernized music, but I grew up in Portugal, in the north of Portugal, in Porto, part of my musical education was fado, which is a type of world music, which is just basically the traditional Portuguese blues, they call it. So that's very dear to me, and every time I hear a good one, I kind of, you know, there's a little sentiment that comes
out.
Sounds
like home.
Yeah, exactly. Sounds like octopus. Grilled octopus by the sea.
Oh, nice. I think the only thing that I've come across that would be worldy and I do really enjoy is actually I watched a TEDx talk on YouTube, which is three Mongolian throat singers also playing some of their traditional instruments and just a regular kind of classical guitar. But I do really enjoy both the harmonies that they go for, which is probably sort of a side effect of the physics of throat singing. Some of the kind of harmonics that get brought out sort of lend themselves to certain harmonies, that kind of thing. But also there's this the one video I'm talking about, one of the performers has this wonderful low register that sounds incredibly raspy but retains a really strong fundamental, so he hits this low note and it's so satisfying.
Brilliant.
I really do enjoy that kind of stuff because they have, they say, those kind of that certain pipe type sound. There's an instrument that they use this particular performance that has a really pleasing soft kind of sound. So it's Tuvan throat singing Alash TEDx Baltimore. If you want to check that one out on YouTube, I really, really like that.
So
I do find that quite relaxing.
Big shout out to Baltimore, Maryland, everyone.
Mm-hmm. So with something like that, are we starting to move away from Western, traditional Western tuning? Because I noticed with the two forms that I spoke about earlier, and I was listening to some of it this morning just before we got involved with this, just to sort of brush up on those two genres. And they were notable that they were very much within the realms of Western tuning, you know, the sort of whole notes and semitones and so forth. But when as you move further and further east, the tuning gets more and more bizarre, if you see what I'm saying. It can really...
Yeah.
So would you say with the throat singing that it sticks within that, or is it starting to creep? Because obviously once we get into sort of China and Japan and... Well, India as well, you know, the tuning goes completely.
It's definitely definitely microtonal because it's following the harmonic series most of the time. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be a lot of fretless instruments, and some of those pipes will be made, that sort of the holes will be drilled in to get the notes that are in tune with literally the human throat. Yes, there's actually a really good bit of notation on Wikipedia that shows the harmonic series and how many cents different it would be as well.
Hmm.
So it's not a specific kind of scale or anything. It's just the human harmonic series, I think they kind of base things around.
Yeah, because it's the resonance of the voice. Mm. That's what creates the upscaling of,
yeah, exactly,
of the tone. Yeah,
because when it gets to the real extreme, it for me, it just completely isn't happening. When you get to the extremes of something like Japanese opera, and you just, it's just...
yeah.
I don't find it a pleasant experience at all.
Tell you what, though, what's it called? A Flying Microtonal Banana, the King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizards album is a great album.
It's
really fun. It does get a little bit much, but most of the songs on that album are really good.
Yeah.
I think they just sort of bought a bunch of microtonal instruments and like, well, it's album time. It's really good. Doom City is one of my favorite tracks. But speaking of harmonics, there's been a bit of a leak, which is on Twitter. I can't remember what the user is, but there is a picture of what looks to be a reworking of the Moog subharmonicon. So the Moog, what's it called, engineers pass at I keep saying Moog, I'm going to annoy certain people, I apologize to our listeners in America, Moogfest. At Moogfest you can pay extra to go and build a new synth with the people from Moog, which is super cool. I wish I had the money, maybe one day. But not the last one, but the one before, they made the subharmonicon, which is two oscillators. Each of those has two subharmonics, so you can do kind of six note chords. And the panel for the original one looks completely different to this. Don't know if this is kind of going to be a final thing, if they're actually mass producing it, if this is an old prototype. Who knows? But there's still the essence of it. Notably, the old... the Moogfest subharmonicon, I think it was sawtooth only. This one looks like we've got toggle switches for square and saw, and then just saw for the two oscillators. Yeah. This was a synth that I really, really wanted, and I did actually visit Moog around the time of the Moog 1 release. I went to Asheville and had a chat. I was like, please mass produce this synth, I really want one. They just went, nah, it's a bit weird. But weird is cool, so I really hope this one comes out, because I will have one immediately. Brilliant. Can you guys see that picture there?
I can see the leaked picture as well.
Yeah, that's the one, yeah. So there's that interesting sequencer on the left. That's where the weird stuff happens. Then you've got your kind of harmonic center in the middle. It's a nice layout. I just don't think it looks as nice as the
original
Moogfest one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, the silver faceplate is cool, but that's just a super limited kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think that's basically it for sort of our planned notes. But Pete, you did have a little nugget in there that we just went through, the just sort of what music do we like, what world music. I reckon something that's quite interesting is sort of going through a cut down version of the development in your kind of taste in music. So I'll do the cut down version of mine quickly while you're thinking of yours. But it's kind of interesting to see which little nuggets of certain genres you've latched onto and how you've gone in different directions in terms of your what you've been feeding your ears with. So I grew up with a lot of Genesis, the whole catalog, lots of 80s pop, and then sort of smattering of other weird artists. Well, not necessarily weird, but artists that just kind of come out of left field, because it's my dad's taste in music, basically. So
sure,
lots of that, bits of Lamb, Garbage, Shakira, weird, just odd bits and pieces, The Feeling, just loads of stuff. But that kind of got me, it gave me an appreciation for different sounds, at least. So I was a bit more open than I think a lot of people were at sort of, you know, 10-ish. My next-door neighbour showed me the band Pendulum, which kickstarted a massive electronic music phase around the time that dubstep was a thing and Skrillex was massive. So I was into a lot of electronic music. But on actually one of my favourite albums of all time, Immersion by Pendulum, there was a collaboration with In Flames, which is a metal band. So there was this all this screaming happening, and I go, I don't hate this. So then I did some metal-y stuff. I'd always been playing guitar anyway, so I got into a little bit of Metallica, some Slipknot, and some other bits and pieces. Then I got into the progressive metal, which married up all the prog rock stuff with the metal that I was into, and that's basically where I am at the moment. Telmo or Pete, who wants to go first? How did you navigate through the musical world?
Pete, well, you go.
That was quite an eclectic sort of fusion of taste that you put together. It sounds
definitely.
Like you were sort of...
A varied diet is good for the health, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, so I'm in the 70s, I as a teenager, went through all the kind of stuff. It was very, I mean, because the outlets or the ability to get exposed to different musics was a lot limited. Obviously, no internet, no, you know, very, you know, 2-3 television channels. I mean, we only had 2 music programs to speak of, which one would have been the Top of the Pops, which is how you sort of found out about what was going on in the charts. And it was the only charts. And I suppose you could accompany that with radio, but it was pretty much sort of stepped in line with what was happening on Top of the Pops. And then for sort of the more interesting live scene, it would be the Old Grey Whistle Test.
Mm. Yeah, I think my taste started out as a lot of Old Grey Whistle Test type stuff, like... I think it's Wishbone Ash were on there once, but it's just directly inherited from my dad who watched it as well.
Yeah, so synthy wise, in the sort of again the sort of the later 70s, it had been Steve Hillage and Tangerine Dream, and obviously there's a bit of synthy stuff going on with Pink Floyd. There's various other bits. Obviously, Jean-Michel Jarre with Oxygen, which was obviously a very commercial album. And then the usual sort of stuff everyone was into, you know, ranging from Elton John, Bowie and Queen.
The good ones.
You know, they were sort of spread out over that period. There was a lot of other really cheesy pop stuff that I tended to ignore. Once we hit the sort of the punk era, I thought punk was just more of a comedy act than a serious genre, which it's in retrospect maybe not I don't know, I mean looking back I perceive it differently now, but at the time I was more into it wasn't even described as metal, it was just called heavy rock I suppose at the time, so it sort of had a bit of a Motorhead sort of period, but I think that was more to do with the sort of style of it all rather than the actual quality of the music. I mean really it was the progressive rock thing, same as you, there was a lot of Genesis, a hell of a lot of Yes, that type of thing, that was my thing. I mean to the point where I formed a progressive rock band in the 80s and we attempted to emulate our heroes in that respect, not to a greater success at all, but it was a good we had a good time with that. Enjoyed a lot of the new wave stuff that followed punk, the electronic stuff, I don't know, Depeche Mode, Human League, all that type of stuff, so very synth orientated. After that, it was just the odd thing that came up. I think my taste had formed to a degree to the point where it was just if something, you know, you could have an artist that would just do one or maybe 2 tracks, or be one track on a particular album, and it would grab me, but the rest wouldn't find that interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I come from completely different. As growing up, a completely different mindset in music than the one that I listen to now. It's funny because there was 2 different routes for me in music. There was the route that will improve my instrument playing, my guitar playing abilities, and you know the sort of music I was listening to bring that to a point where I was, you know, excited to play music. And then the other route was the songwriting and the production route. So the value that songwriting and production had in a certain, it could be anything. It could be a synth track, that has in a particular artist, from a particular artist or an album. So I, you know, it's weird, but I grew up listening to a lot of British heavy metal, a lot of doom metal, a lot of 80s hair, California, Sunset Strip, yeah. Guns N' Roses, makeup, Poison kind of thing, because my dad was a massive, massive fan. He had magazines. He hosted a radio show back in the 80s in Portugal, which was the first heavy metal radio show ever in the country. So
that's pretty
cool. He's got all sorts of stories as well. So it's quite interesting. And I've got all of this memorabilia back from the day that keeps coming back to me. So I grew up listening to that, but then, you know, you start building your own sounds. I was very interested in the blues. I kind of like gradually went down from the 80s up down into the 40s. You know, I had my 70s, my 60s, my 50s, my 40s phase.
Did a little bit of a time travel through the music world.
Because the more I was digging, I was like, oh, okay, so Led Zeppelin was learning, were doing these songs because of these guys from the 40s. Yeah. I was like, okay, so these guys from the 40s are now, oh man, this is like, it was like an endless loop. And so that was great for me. It was like an historic way of looking at music, which I kind of
How
still
far
have.
Back did you end up going? What's the earliest kind of bit of music where you've gone, ah, okay, this is where it all came from?
Yeah, I think it was like the 20s. Like with because the blues just created everything. I suppose this can be arguable, of course, but I think the blues have a massive fingerprint in music and just all the music. And then I've reached a certain maturity, and then I started to look at current music, and again at more of a let's say mental kind of like less physical, but a bit more of a different side to music. You know, I was like you've mentioned, Pete. You've mentioned specific parts in a song that you really like, even if the artist is not, you know, something that you listen to every day. You know, like I had that for Tears for Fears. You know, that beginning in Everybody Wants to Rule the World. You see, that first 30 seconds of the song really made the whole song for me. I thought it was a brilliant song. I started to listen to a lot of...
It's a guitar arpeggio, isn't it?
Yeah, and synth as well. So I started to listen to a lot of indie, Bon Iver, to a lot of folk as well, like 2000s. And then I found myself listening to jazz, and it all changed. But that has been
And then the Telmo we know today was born.
That was it, yeah. About 5 years ago, I finally thought that I had enough maturity to listen to jazz, because I think you know I've always knew it's the same with classical. I've always knew that there was going to be a time when I was going to explore that sort of music, but I wasn't ready. And you know, you kind of know when you're ready, and when you do, then you make the leap.
I think it changed for me once I started getting involved in music and then music production latterly, because the way I listened to music changed dramatically. Because I stopped, in some respects, being able to appreciate it just for what it was. You start listening to it critically and you start dismantling it. And in twofold, you're sort of listening to potentially musical technique in respect to how the instruments have been played. But you also start listening to production techniques and how that's gone through. And the trouble is that a lot of the times I just find myself doing an autopsy on anything I'm listening to.
Yeah, I totally know that feel.
That can kind of destroy the pleasure to a degree, because you're not listening to it in a, I think the best way to describe it, in an innocent way.
Yeah.
In a non-judgment, you know, just listening to it for what it is, which is should be the case for, I would imagine, most people who experience music, because... the greater proportion of people listening to music aren't necessarily musicians or producers.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's I totally know what you mean. It's kind of similar to me wishing I didn't know anything about modular synthesizers, because I could just try and patch things and be really surprised. But yeah, trying to get back to that mental state of just being able to let some music wash over you, not think about it, just enjoy it. We're gonna, I think, probably close out this episode giving some recommendations again from YouTube to entertain you if you've got time to twiddle your thumbs. But one of the artists that I can actually do that with is Atreyu's Horse. So if you know The Neverending Story, Atreyu is the main character from the first one? I don't really know. Atreyu is a character from Neverending Story anyway. Atreyu's Horse is an artist who's on YouTube and Instagram, makes some really nice modular, ambient, soundscapey type things, often includes the piano in there as well, sometimes a Rhodes. And it's something I can actually just... I sometimes watch the video to see what's going on, but most of the time I just kind of let it wash over me, and it's quite a... meditative one. So I definitely recommend giving those tunes a go. Yes. Not a massive amount of them, but each and every one of them is excellent. Any recommendations from you chippity chaps?
I mean, I don't have any music specifically. I guess I could mention one that you and me, Bed, we know quite well, and I just can't believe we haven't mentioned this yet. It's Bill Wirtz. Or Bill Wirtz.
Oh, man. Oh, what a guy. Yes.
Absolute legend. If you don't know Bill Wirtz, you need to go on YouTube now and just write sexy pants. Hello, sexy pants. And the most brilliant kind of videos will pop out. I mean, it's just a pleasure to watch such brilliantly made music. It's almost a meme.
Yeah, the videos that accompany his stuff are really great as well. It's almost like it's a little view into his mind, which is quite interesting.
I love that.
Really fun. Whimsical, I think, is the word as well. But I think you can probably comment more on this, Talma. It does sound like he's got a good amount of musical theory understanding in there as well, because he does do some pretty strange moves, to me make total sense, because they're just, here's this incredibly jarring thing to accompany the lyrics, which
that
make
happens
no sense.
every 5 seconds, isn't it? He's got like a
pretty
little
much.
He gives you a pop lesson every turn around. It's like, this is how you do it, and this is how you do it, and then there's a whole sense of nostalgia, like 90s, 2000s for, you know, us millennials. I was born in 92, but if you grew up with Windows 98 and Windows 2000, there is instant nostalgia. So yeah, there's that aesthetic side as well, and the music is brilliant. There's not really much I can dismantle in more than a couple of minutes, but it's definitely something to look at. And if you want something Britishly funny, something that's quite British and funny, have a look at Damien Slash, as in
Damien Slash.
A-M-I-E-N Slash. He's got videos such as How to Be a Male Feminist, or Lawrence the Gamer, but my favorite
one, first series, is it Mineral Splash?
Yes,
I love Mineral Splash so much.
Mineral Water Reviews, Mineral Splash, the famous program. There's something in the tap water, and that something is cancer. It's just beautiful British humor.
Yeah, definitely a good one. I'd also recommend watching the Banker.
Yes,
he's always good. He's a bit of a voice actor, comedian.
He works for the BBC. Yeah.
Oh, does he? Nice.
Yeah. He did a few mixtapes as well. For BBC Four that went on air in 2017. So he's been doing this sort of stuff for quite a long time. But he's just a very intelligent guy.
What do you got, Pete?
Right, as usual, I've plumbed the depths of my YouTube subscription list, and I've come up with something that's completely non-musical. So the one for this week that I would point people towards is, the channel is called the Samson Boat Company.
Okay.
So what this is a guy called, the gentleman's name is Leo Samson Goulden, G-O-O-L-D-E-N, Goulden.
Goulden.
Anyway, this gentleman has taken on the task of renovating a English sailing yacht, which is completely made of wood, which was originally built in 1909. And to cut a long story short, eventually ended up sort of semi-wrecked on the west coast of America, which is where he's actually, even though he's English himself, he's building it on the family friend's place, who conveniently got a fantastic wood sort of workshop. And I think I've been following him for a good 18 months, maybe even 2 years. We're at episode 70. He typically does an episode a week. And I don't know about you guys, but it's one of those where you don't have to be particularly into boats or anything like that. It's just seeing people do something creative who are very skilled at what they do. There's some you can just
definitely
watch them. You can sort of half watch this or intently watch it, depending on how you're disposed at the time. But it's just the level of skill and competency in sort of the woodworking and so forth. And it just goes at a gentle pace. And every week he tracks his progress, and he's sort of proceeding quite nicely. I mean, to be honest, at the end of the day, even though he's restoring the boat, there's going to be an absolute smidgen of the original boat left. He's literally replaced it. But he's got the original plans from the designer, 1909, and he's following those. And he sort of, as you go, you get a lesson in how wooden boats are actually constructed. And this thing is, it's not a little dinghy. It's a pretty big, when you see these things out the water and you can see the whole hull. I mean, this boat was quite successful in its time, and it actually was one of the first winners of the Fastnet race.
Hmm, that sounds very interesting, man. I'm going to have to check that out.
So that's my one for this week.
Golden.
Yeah, and I totally know what you mean about that.
That's brilliant.
Just watching somebody who is a master of their craft, even if it's something that a hobby you'll never pick up or something. It's like I occasionally come across videos from the lock picking lawyer, which I find very interesting, even though I have no interest in picking locks at all. But because it's a mechanism that he'll be forcing and then dissecting and explaining, that's really nice. Another one, which is kind of my equivalent to watching a Bob Ross video, is watching Peter Chan from Heron's Bonsai. He's just talking about the philosophy and techniques behind bonsai, and because it's such a patient art, and he just has such a lovely way of speaking, it's one of those things you can just let it wash over you, and you're kind of in nature with him. So that'd be another one. Heron's Bonsai, if you do want to take a trip. But thank you very much for listening to us and being part of this episode 22. We'll see you next week. Episode 23, we'll have some new nuggets for you. Stay safe out there and see you around. Bye.